members and allow the department to show. Then after the department, after the responses, we will I've been harassed, but there's nothing I can do about it because there's one entity that would like to present, since they're here, UIF. Then after that, we then, so those that had some questions, they will then, after the UIF has presented, they will then, in acting, they will then make a follow-up on those. So SMTG, are you ready on the spot?
Thanks, Chair. Mr. Morotama is going to talk to the SEE and the public information related questions. The COO will talk to the, there was a question on how to set our targets and that we're setting targets that are easy to achieve. She'll talk to the process. DDG Matevis is going to talk to issues around policy issues in terms of retention and issues around exit interviews and so on. And then she will also talk to communication together with Makoso. I'll come in at the end to cover the gap. And probably the commissioner, CF, will talk to the questions that you raised. I'll come in after the commission. So in that order. Thanks. Over to you.
Thank you, Acting DG. There were questions around whether we have an operation and maintenance budget. The answer is yes, we do. In our annual report and at the back of the financial statement of the FEE, when we tabled the report or in the previous one, we do budget for various aspects. I was just indicating that the money that we normally receive from Treasury is up to a certain limit, it's 154 million per annum. But unlike other entities, we are expected to generate additional revenue to do other things. Otherwise, we would be totally dependent on the allocations, and I don't think the Treasury was going to accept it. They would simply shut the institution down. And the same thing with the asset management. We do have, just that the entities are big. We have in total 18 factories. Now, the assets range from big machinery up to various screwdrivers and you know, a whole range of other small units. We're talking about thousands and thousands of small assets in the factory, including materials. I mean, if you're talking about things that we buy to manufacture desks, it's trucks and trucks of wood panels. And the issue with the AG is that we must have the price of each and every piece of wood that we keep in the factory so that we can provide a fair value. It's something new. Previously, the different auditors had agreed with our method of calculations because you normally have invoices and so on. On the issue around the FIPS, this is a strategic infrastructure project. Apologies that we used that acronym without writing. There's a slide also on chronic disabilities. Now, normally, and that was associated with FEE as well. The slide was basically giving an indication of the number of people that we register within public employment services, and those are we have slides that talk to segments of various disabilities, and they would normally cite those. However, in SEE, in line with the Employment Services Act, there are specific people that we employ as defined in terms of the Act and in line with the United Nations. It's not everybody with every level of disability. It is those people with whose disabilities makes it very difficult for them to function in a normal work environment, and are referred to us by special schools and various psychiatrists after assessment. Other people with various disabilities are normally employed in factories, other than the FEEs. We have 10 of them that we subsidize, as if they've got, they are separate, they are not departmental. They employ in the region of 650. Next year's number is going to increase to 900. And we give them a subsidy, a flat rate subsidy of 800 rand for every person they employ, whether it's blind, people with mobility impairment, and so on. And we also give factories a subsidy for their operational areas. The CFO did show a slide that indicates the transfers to organizations of people with disabilities. There was a question.
Sorry for that. If, because I don't want to lose this, if you can, I may have been a bit confused on the slide. The one that talks about chronic disability. Where is that?
The one. This one was talking to Work Seekers Register.
Work Seekers Register.
Slide number 71.
Is it slide number 71?
No, 73. Apologies.
Oh, okay.
So this
yeah,
one.
That's, yeah, okay. Okay. Maybe somebody will have to, my apologies, because I really do want to unpack for me this chronic condition. Which are those conditions? Maybe the activity to then be able to unpack so that I understand. So if it was not under your presentation, it's fine. That's under the department, of the, then a person will then be able to really take to make us to understand.
Public employment falls under me.
It falls under
yes,
you.
Yes. And what we're depicting in terms of this slide, and maybe it may be a problem of a better way to describe the sector. That's why you have etc. At the end. But when people come to us to register, the form requires that if they have some level of disabilities, they indicate or they disclose. And in the form, normally work seekers will say, I'm visually impaired, or I've got speech impairment, etc., or I have a hearing disabilities, etc., because we employers in meeting their equity target also come to us to say, give us people with disabilities, and we will go straight to the database and extract those. Now, chronic, maybe it could be one of lack of a better word, because it's all the all-encompassing kind of disability conditions that we group together. We could have said others or whatever, and we'll look for a better way. I mean, if there's a another definition that could encompass other forms of disabilities other than what the mobile capture will welcome. I think that the other question related to factors that contribute towards unemployment. Now, that's a big issue. It ranges from the economic, it's a world, it's an international phenomenon. And I think last week, the DG did try to answer that question, in that if in an environment where you don't have economic growth, you would obviously have unemployment. Where you don't have major investment, you will have unemployment. Where countries or companies are not expanding or they are diversifying their products and using high-tech equipment, you will have those factors contributing towards unemployment. The macro issues that contribute towards the situation, and that is why collectively government and the president has pronounced a number of measures that tries to attract investment and a whole range of other measures to try and deal with that phenomenon. Now, there was a question around the status. Now, what we do in the department, and Honorable Chairperson, you will have to advise me. I thought in your opening remarks, you were very clear that you are dealing with the historical, which is quarter four. We do have quarter one, and I think at the appropriate time, we present the current statistics. And I think it cuts across the whole department. We have that information. I think depending on the dates that we are going to give, we will come with that information. We do have slides also that show, I think that there are slides that show the contribution by each of our labor centers. On the performance in terms of placement, in terms of registration. You'll notice that it can go back. Slide number 71, for instance, will give you a breakdown of the registration per province. We'll have another slide on the counseling per province. We'll have another slide on placement problems, and that depicts the contribution of each problem. Below that is just that information can be massive. In Gauteng, for instance, we will have 24 labor centers. Now, under each province, we do have slides that shows the individual contribution of a labor center in a particular area, so that the province can then say, as Gauteng, this is our contribution, and we do the same with other areas, because that's how we process information. Thank you.
Thank you. If I understood the question on the matter of the indicators correctly, it was about the number of indicators, that is 4 and 3 and 5 and so on, and that it is therefore easy to achieve. That's correct. Okay. We had a couple of years ago, we had quite a number of indicators on our annual performance plan. For example, in the case of inspection and enforcement services, we would unpack the 4 types of inspections or the 5 types of inspections. And we were advised then by DPME, the Auditor General and so forth, that we are doing exactly that, what you are thinking we are doing. If we have 15 and you don't achieve 2, the impact on your total performance is much smaller. than when you combine, for example, all inspections, because inspections are inspections, whether it's PCA, what. So if you have four indicators in inspection and enforcement services, of which one, for example, is inspection, and you don't achieve that, then you have not had an achievement of 25%. Whereas if it's one of 15, your percentage non-achievement is substantially lower. And that is why you will see that we have our targets, our indicators set, we've combined them to decrease them, because then your non-achievement will have a bigger impact. We have also, when we do set our indicators, look at our resources available, human as well as physical resources. It's very easy to set a very high SMART target and try and come and impress this committee with huge numbers, and then we don't achieve them. So we set the holistic indicators that we know is achievable, given if we do our planning, management and so forth correctly. But the number of indicators, that was the reason why they have decreased from... At some stage, I think we had them in the cities, and we've kept on decreasing them by combining and becoming smarter and smarter in terms of how we set the indicators.
Thank you, Chairperson. The question on the interventions on staff turnover and any measures that we have employed to mitigate that. What we do, we've done. I will talk about Northern Cape later, or maybe the 18DG will add on, because it's specific about inspectorate. But basically within the department, we do conduct exit interviews, and then we also have an analysis of that. We draw out a report. I can share the report with the committee if needs be, Chairperson, got that report. I was just waiting for it. It's taking a bit of time to come through, but we do have an analysis report on the exit interviews that we conduct. And then on top of that, in terms of retention, because for me retention is a culture that you need to build within an institution. For us to retain our staff, we've got, for example, under inspectorate, we provide them with the tools of trade that make their job easier to do. That's number one. Number two, I'll give an example of the tools of trade, which are cell phones, iPads, inspection-related tools, like even cars, yes, vehicles. And then on top of that, to ensure that we treat inspection and enforcement services as a core business, we, over time, I think the department realized that in order to retain the inspectors, there need to be some form of upward mobility within the department. Whereas in the previous times, we used to have inspectors at level 5, 6, and 7, and there was no upward progression. At the moment, we're talking of inspectors at the director level. So there's upward mobility within the department. You can be an inspector until you reach a director position within the department. And then also we've revised our bursary scheme. We used to provide bursaries at, I think it was 50%, 40%, depending on the program that people pursue, would then give you a certain portion of the fees that you need to pay an educational institution to pursue your studies. Now we've decided that we're going to give 100%, because some people would want to study, they would then be given maybe 100,000 and they're running short of 10,000 and they can't study. So we decided to make it 100%. But then it obviously impacts on the numbers that we can take at one particular point in time. But the fact is that a person would get a bursary, a full bursary, not a portion of the bursary. Okay, the other one, which is an obvious one, is training. We expose our staff to management training, those that are in management positions, management executive development programs, and normal on-the-job training, and your soft skills training where it needs to be. And in the Northern Cape, I think the 18DG will elaborate further on that. In the Northern Cape, we've got a challenge of the environment of the Northern Cape. Northern Cape is a particularly mining area, and our inspectors, mostly that OHS and other topics, maybe engineers and people like that, would be attracted by better salaries that are being offered in the mining, in the mine. So we tend to have that bit of competition with the mining. We can try and compete, but remember that the public service is also governed by, you know, salaries that are kept at a certain level, whereas in the mines, maybe they've got the latitude of even giving a better offer, you know, just a flexible budget salary offers. And then on the other program where we, even on the inspectorate, I think the ACDG will also elaborate further, is that we do have a pool of inspectors that we pull from. We've got people inspectors that we take through a program of learning. If somebody wants to pursue, maybe say for example, engineering, electrical engineering, we take that person, put them through an education institution to study engineering. And then when they finish, we then absorb them at the end of the program. So I don't know whether there's something that I left out. I know there was another item on communication. Marco Sonke will comment on that.
Thank you. So with regards to using mainstream media, yes, we do. We do use radio stations like Umhlobo Wenene. For example, this past weekend we had an outreach campaign in Limpopo where we used most popular radio stations, and in fact we even had an interview on Umhlobo Wenene. That's how they were interested in the campaign. But I might as well add that currently there is an educational campaign that we are doing with SABC Education, and we use mostly radio stations that are under SSDC, your Mshobo NN, and all the vernacular radio stations, including Sonder Friends. So we do use popular mainstream radio stations.
Thank you, Chair. The questions on the quality of the devices that we give. So the process of the fund is that annually we publish the tariffs that we pay for different procedures, medical procedures, hospitalization and the like. That's the rate that each treating practitioner will then need to charge for services they render to the injured workers. We then, as part of the list, is the list on all devices. So what we publish in the list would be the standard in terms of the specific description of the type of device that a person needs to get. We don't procure the device ourselves, so the person will go to a treating practitioner, an orthotist or an occupational therapist that will treat the client, and then send an authorization request to the fund for the fund to approve for the practitioner to dispense the medical device. And once they dispense the medical device, they will then claim the money from us as part of their medical account that they submit to the fund. So we won't prescribe to the practitioner what type of brand and so on, but they have to be within the specifications that are in the gazette that we set.
Thank you, Anna. I just want to add on the issue of target settings, that you also have independent quality assurance. So it's not like we're the player in the referee. So our target setting also involves layers wherein the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation will scrutinize our year-in and year-out APPs to make sure that we stick to baselines and there is no leniency with regard to how we spend our target. Treasury also comes to play. So they very carefully look at what is it that we achieved in the like past 5 years or so, and is there an increment in terms of quality and quantity of the targets that we set. I just wanted to add that element with regards to the target setting environment. With regards to the staff turnover of the inspectors, I think DDG Corporate Services covered it extensively. I just want to say, Chair, it's almost like you are in IES environment, because the reasons that we stated are precisely that. Our inspectors get poached. I can give you an example. I had an OHS inspector in Mashishin, Lydenburg area, that was poached by a company in CM Port. They paid him up to 5 times what he was earning. So, and we train them well, because we house the primary law, which is occupational health and safety, and all the 24 regulations that come with it. So our inspectors are quite, they're experts in their own area. We've got chemical engineers, we've got construction engineers, we've got health and hygiene specialists, and so on. In some instances, when you recently went to conduct an inspection in Goodyear in Port Elizabeth, the quality of the presentation, we actually had the main guys sitting overseas listening in to what our inspectors are producing. So they get exposed, they get poached, and you can't match the salaries. So that is the reality. The other area that we be experiencing problems, although not to the extent of OHS inspectors, is with regard to our auditors, the ones that look into UI and CF. They come in understanding that they're probably going to be doing purely auditing, and then they come in as more than that, sometimes expectations not matching with the reality, and they don't stay for too long. Statutory services also is where we're picking up a certain level of turnover. But in the Northern Cape, it's more prevalent than any other province because there's a high mobility rate. So you find that people that are inspectors that are in Northern Cape are not originally from there. And originally, it may also mean localized. But you know, the provincial office that houses most of the specialists is in Kimberley. And you find that somebody's coming from Springbok, which is more than 800 kilometers. So they rather go to a neighboring place. So it's dynamics that play themselves out like that. So what the office in Northern Cape is doing, they are linking very closely with some Black University just to get and try and get local schools. But some interventions are more long-term than others. But what we do in instances like that, as head office, because we've got specialists, inspectors that are in head office, that are technical experts and they assist provinces across the board. We then look at the, that's where you see that on the whole you'll be achieving 100%, although a particular province may not be achieving, but you go in there and help. So the service recipients will not be compromised. But on paper, when you look at the targets, you'll find that a particular province may not have achieved, because the target is linked to a person rather than. I hope that makes sense. Like if I'm based in Horizon, I go and assist in Northern Cape, it will still be my work, it will be credited to me. But actually the benefit has gone to the province. So when it comes to looking at the performance on paper, it may appear like this province has not achieved. So that's the detail that I wanted to add. And also to say on the periodic basis, we bring in people inspectors for specialized areas. We recruit them directly from institutions of higher learning, take them through on-the-job training, internship programs, and thereafter we employ them. So we do that on a continuous basis. There was a question on how do our contraventions benefit the workers and the employers specifically. It was linked to the DG reviews. But in my response to this, I want to say, when you approach our inspections work, there are three pillars that we carry out. It's advocacy, it's inspection, it's enforcement. So inherently, when inspectors go out to conduct inspections, it is inherently required that there must be some element of advocacy that they need to do. So they will take, if it's an employment entity inspection, they will take spend some time taking both the employers and employees through the offerings of the legislation. Thereafter, conduct an inspection, and then where there are contraventions, notices will be issued. And where there isn't compliance, they will enforce. But to respond directly with regards to DG reviews, after we've conducted a DG review and we find that a company is not compliant, we serve what we call DG recommendations. So when we serve DG recommendations, we serve them to the CEO, but the requirement by law is that all the members of the local employment equity forum must be there. Because remember, when you talk issues of transformation, all the interested parties need to be there. So it will be all the layers. If people with disabilities, there must be representation. Women, there must be representation. Even men are represented. And then the color issues will come to play. And also different levels, like from top management all the way down. So the local employment equity forum must be like that, led by the CEO. So when you set recommendations, everyone is there. They know what the areas of contraventions are and what the management will be committing to. So basically that is how we approach it. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you. Now we're done with the questions from the first round. Can I then repeat my request and my proposal? That was an indication from one member that he wanted to ask a question. Myself too, I've got one. We allow UIF to present before I am being charged by the speaker of ignoring an entity that has come to make a presentation. That is on a lighter note. He has been crying, he's just about to burst now, and so I don't want him to throw a tantrum. Allow UIF to make a presentation, then in the context of then asking a question and just pick on those that may be of an interest in the light in the previous presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson, and afternoon, honorable members. I believe in the last presentation last week, Commissioner did provide some background about what the UIF is all about. So I'll just start from slide 8, just to highlight to members that the performance that we are presenting to the committee now has been independently reviewed by our internal audit. So when we say we have achieved something, internal audit first will look at it and look at the supporting evidence, and they will only agree with us if we are able to provide evidence. So the slide from them to slide 12 is just to give your members confirmation that internal audit did review our performance and they are happy with what we have reported. Then we'll move to slide 13. So in slide 13, Chair, we're giving performance of the UIF in the last financial year, just to indicate that we've got 6 strategic objectives, and in those 6 strategic objectives, we've got about 16 indicators that we measure ourselves on. And there the presentation just gave a highlight in terms of our performance from quarter 1 until quarter 4. And in the next slide, I'll just get into the detail on the performance on quarter 4. The first strategic objective is to ensure financial sustainability. We've got 3 performance indicators in there. In quarter 3, I believe when the commissioner reported, he did touch on this, we did achieve, and still in quarter 4, we're still achieving on the same target, which is more about we measure ourselves on the time we take to pay our service providers, and also on the investment, on the our investment mandate on social responsible investment. And we have performed according to the target. In the next slide, on slide 15, it talks about the vacancy rate, which is one target that we did not achieve at the end of the financial year. I think, Chairperson, one of the challenges that we were facing last year was we were getting a lot of complaints from our clients because we've got the national call center where all the people who've got inquiries about UIF, they were calling to. So there were a number of issues because people are complaining that we take time to answer to calls. And the main reason for that was the number of call center agents that we have vis-a-vis the number of calls that we are receiving per day. when the number of our agents were not sufficient. So we look into the structure. We created about 32 additional posts for people to come and assist in the call center. Now, for a call center agent, the requirement there, you'll just need someone with 6 months experience and metrics. So when we advertised, we received about 11,000 applications. Because when you, in terms of placement in the public sector, we need to go to different media platforms when we advertise posts. So the numbers were quite high. And in terms of the HR processes, is for fair process, you need to go through each and every CV. So we need to create a database of 11,000 candidates that could have applied, and we'll have to shortlist from that 11,000 candidates for about we had about 32 posts, and we had to shortlist about 5 for each post. So the process took very long because of the administration that it came with. So as a result, we were not able to fill this post at the end of the financial year. But in the current financial year, I think when we report on quarter one, will indicate that we managed to fill those posts. The other indicator that we did not do good on, it's on the installing the Wi-Fi to our labor centers. One of the things that we have picked up was when people go and apply in our offices, there's been number of queues and the time we take to service the client. So we introduced the online system about 3 years ago where people don't have to come to our office to apply for benefit. They can actually sit at home and apply. But what we picked up was the issue that people will have challenges in accessing the internet because we're saving the people that are unemployed. So we decided that we're going to implement the Wi-Fi services in our labor centers. So if someone comes to our office, he doesn't necessarily have to queue to be serviced, but he can go into our offices, access our Wi-Fi, and process their application through the online system. However, there were a bit of delays in the appointment of the service provider due to the process that took longer in our procurement process. So as a result, by the time we appointed the service provider, we were not in a position to implement the Wi-Fi in all the labor centers as we targeted 126. We only managed to do 233 labor centers, but we are implementing in the new financial year, and I think we'll give more progress when we do quarter one of the current financial year. The other objective that we did not achieve, we embarked into a project where we needed to implement an ERP system, and the main objective of it was for us to have one integrated system in the fund, because we currently have different systems in finance, and we've got another system in operations. So in normal, when you need to verify, especially when coming to the compliance of the employer, we'll have to go independently into different systems before you get a full picture. So one of the objectives of the system was we were all going to use one system in the fund, whether it's HR, finance, and operation, which was going to make improve on the service that we give to the client because of the quick information that we'll access. So this project, we planned to implement it in 3 years. We started. While we are halfway with the implementation, there were issues that were picked up with the contract or the service provider that was appointed. And there was an investigation that had to happen, and we had to pause a bit on the project because of if it becomes an irregular expenditure, we needed to manage the amount that will end up disclosing in our financial as irregular. So we waited for that investigation to be finalized. By the time we finalized the process and we continue, the appointed service provider could not finalize all the work that they were supposed to do before the contract came to an end. So we had a report that were outstanding, and one of the key things, because the first system that we're focusing on was to do the financial system, and one of the key things is when you've got a financial system, you must have the report that goes with it. Otherwise, it will be you just capturing information, but you'll not be able to report. So we couldn't implement the system without the report. So as a result, we were not able to implement that system according to the timeline. But we appointed another service provider that will have to continue to where the previous one left off. But before they could do that, we had to do the old service provider would have to do the handover to the new service provider. So unfortunately, that process could not be finalized at the end of the financial year in March. However, the process is continuing, so we'll report the progress on that when we do quarter one of the current financial year.
Thank you.
The next slide, which page 17, this talks to the core of what UIF is all about, because UIF exists to pay benefits to the UIF unemployment clients. And just to indicate that, though you, I think you have seen that the overall performance of the fund is sitting at 63%, but in areas where it's our core of what UIF exists for, we did achieve. And that indicates where we're measuring ourselves more on the turnaround time we take to pay our clients when they, or to process the application of the client. So we just divided it into three different targets, where we pay for death benefit, unemployment, your illness and maternity, and the turnaround time of them are different. But in the previous financial year, we did very well in all of those areas that we achieved. In the next slide, in slide 18, still on service delivery, there we, after the client process an application, so it goes through a process where we will approve or reject an application, but in an instance where we reject or indicate the reasons why the application was not successful, but for those that are approved, then the client will have to submit another form where they give us the banking detail and they give us a confirmation that they are still unemployed, and we measure ourselves to say as soon as we receive this information, we need to pay the client within 6 days. And we did very well, where we have achieved, the target was 95%, and we achieved 99% of that. And the other one, it was on registration of companies. I think when the acting DG indicated was the compliance. So one of the responsibilities, companies must register with the UIF in terms of law. So here we've set the target to say for us to increase compliance, we must register these companies as soon as possible. So the timeline that we have given ourselves is if a company wants to register with UIF, we need to finalize that registration within a day. And in the previous year, we did well. All the registration that we received were finalized within a year. The other one that we did not do good on, it was on the compliance certificate. So here, the challenge was that the process is highly manual, and it normally takes us time to process this. But the reason behind it is companies take forever, they don't comply, like the FDG has indicated. Where we normally catch them is when they want to do business with government, there's a requirement that you must be complying with UI legislation. So you find a company that has been in existence, not registered with UIF, not contributing, then all of a sudden there's a tender in government they want to apply for, and the requirement is UI certificate. Now they will come to us, but it means us will have to go back to 10 years record to check the compliance of this company, because we have to go back 10 years, check how many employees did they have, did they pay those, and all of that. So normally that takes us time. That's one of the contributory factors on why in the last financial year, we couldn't finalize those in 10 days. But what we have done in the current financial year, we're currently now automating this process where it's no longer manual. There's a system that we're currently implementing, and I think in quarter three is the target we have given ourselves where this process will be done automatically, no longer manual. In the next slide, in slide 19, it talks to the number of employers, which is also part of the... So here we're not measuring ourselves on the turnaround time of how long we take to register a company. Here we measure ourselves of how many number of companies we manage to get them to comply with the UIF and for them to register in our database. So in the previous financial year, we did very good. However, we had the issue of we had to move our data center to a different location. So we were occupying a building that we were using as UI head office, and our data center was sitting there, but we relocated to a new building because the building that we were occupying was not meeting the standard that it should be occupied. But we couldn't move with the data center, so the data center was left there, but because of the condition of the building, we had to move the data center. So we did find a new place of moving the data center. However, in moving the data center, we had to get our system shut down for a particular period of time where we couldn't provide service because we had to wait for the successful migration of the data center. So because it happens towards the end of the financial year, that 2 weeks, that period that we took for the data center move, by the time the system went up and we had to continue with the work, we received a number of companies that were supposed to be registered, but we were not successfully to manage to register all those companies within March. So we end up continuing doing it in April, but because it's the end of the financial year, we had to give the statistics at the end of March. So that's one of the main contributors why we did not achieve on that. In the next slide, in slide 20, this one talks to our labor activation program, and I think the commissioner gave background last week that this program is focusing on, because as a UIF, our main objective is not just to pay people when they are unemployed. We also want to train them to make sure that these people are able to go back into the labor market and to re-enter the labor market. And in some instances, you pick up that the reason why they're not able to re-enter is because of the number of the level of skill that they have. So we go through our database and identify these people and identify them for different training programs. Unfortunately, we targeted those numbers in the previous financial year. Now, for us to train these people, we partner with a different institution. We work with the TVET colleges, we work with the CETAs. In the other year, I think in 2017-18, Auditor General indicated, because previously we'll just approach an institution to partner with them and train our beneficiaries, but there was a recommendation that we need to follow a transparent process where we have to issue the request for proposal in different media platforms for transparency. So we followed that process in 2017-18 with the intention that in 2019-20, which is the year we are reporting, we just training people. So we followed the process, we went out, but we appointed a company that Deloitte that had to come and look at the process to check there were no non-compliance in the process as we went out, and they found some areas of non-compliance. So through the probit report, their recommendation was we must restart the process from the beginning. Now, as we were in the 18-19, we had to restart the process, but in our planning, 18-19 was supposed to be the year where we are training. So we were impacted by the fact that we had to, first part of the year was to restart the process and appoint service providers, so we could only train in the second part of the year. So as a result, it impacted on the number of trainees that we could train in that particular year. But in the current financial year, Chair, the numbers are improving very well because that recruitment process has already been finalized. Within the same project, there's also the training layoffs. This is where we go to companies that they've got difficulty, they will want to close their businesses because of different institutions. So we'll go there, look at what are the issues, and then we'll look at the employees that will work there, and will provide these employees with different training so that they will be able to be re-employed in other areas. So I'll move then, Chair. I think that summarizes, slide 21, just summarize, just a repeat of what I've just indicated. If you can move to slide 23. Chair, there we just want to highlight to the committee, when I said we've met all our targets in terms of the turnaround time, just to show that we are doing an incremental targeting, because previously our target was for us to process claims within 35 days, but in the current year that I've reported that we have achieved, we actually reduced the time we take. We divided the 35 days, unemployment benefit, we pay them within 15 days. In service, we pay them from 10 days, and then deceased, we pay them from 20 days. So that slide is just to reflect that though we made our target to be shorter, but we did manage to perform. So we'll move over, Chair, from there, and then just move to slide 26. In slide 26, Chair, until slide 31, until slide 30, it's just giving different breakdown on provinces, the very same target that I've just explained of the turnaround time, so it's just reflecting on how the different provinces perform in all those different targets. So I'll skip that, and then I will go to slide 32 or slide 33. Chair, there it just indicates the rent value of this benefit, because on the other target we are just measuring the turnaround time and the volumes of claim, but in this one it's just measuring, we're just looking at quarter four to indicate the comparing what we paid in quarter four in the previous financial year compared to the current financial year. And you can see there that there was an increase, because in the 17-18 quarter four we paid about 2.4 billion and for quarter four of 18-19 we paid for 2.9 billion. And shall request us to move then to slide 36, just to give members our financial performance that is linked to our strategic performance. I've indicated different programs that we have, and they just to indicate that for program one, which is administration, we have utilized 88% of the budget that was allocated, so there was an underspending of 12%. On business operation, which is the core business, we actually went, we paid more than what we budgeted for, and I will explain it further. On the other program was on the labor activation, where we only spent 13% of the budget. If members can recall, when we were dealing with the labor activation, I did indicate we didn't meet the target because we started the process late, and this is reflected on the budget. So because we didn't train number of people that we intended to train, so we couldn't spend 100% of the budget, we just spent 13% of that. On program two and business operation, this is the over expenditure is based on the benefit payment. So on annual basis, we'll budget to say we'll pay benefit to our clients of about 10 or 9 or 8 billion. But that's just an estimation. But at the end of the day, we've got obligation of paying for each and every claim that comes through. So the over expenditure is not like we have misused the money, but it's because it's a true reflection that we have paid more benefit than what we budgeted for. And this is emanating from the fact that at the end of the last financial year, which was in January 2019, we implemented the new Amendment Act. And the main objective of the Amendment Act was to pay more benefit to clients than previously it was. In terms of the breakdown, when we look into the economic classification, the compensation of employees, there we underspend. This is emanating from what I explained earlier. We didn't fill the call center post on time, which was part of what we budgeted for, so that's what has contributed to us not spending on compensation of employees. Goods and services, in there we also budget for our social responsible investment, so we'll budget to say we'll make a surplus of this amount of money. However, in the current financial year, there were some losses on our social responsible investment that was has impacted that. On the CAPEX, there's also an under expenditure there. It's emanating from what I've just explained. We didn't implement that SAP system on time, so as a result, the budget was not expensed for that. So that's what has caused the under expenditure in the CAPEX. On the transfer, that's where the benefit payment is, and I've already explained the over expenditure was as a result of us paying more benefit. That brings end to my presentation. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much, all of the members. Great presentation. Any questions? Okay. Honorable Nunes, that one. If Honorable Banji, yes, you are studying.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. From the first presentation on compensation fund, there was a mention of close to a million claims that you had a target on, and you paid out almost 95%. My concern is on the issue of the number of claims. in relation to health and safety, whether there has been any synergy and reconciliation between the entity and the department as far as inspections are concerned, and what would therefore then be the global value of that 940 something thousand claims that you had to settle, if ever there is any breakdown between private and public sectors of those claims. My second question relates to the internships. I'm told that there was, or the department had internships from various sectors in various districts. Is it still continuing? If not, why? And if ever it is continuing, what is the program going forward? The underspending, the 214.5 seems to be a substantial amount. Take into account there is no breakdown that says for vacancies is so much, for goods and services is so much, so that we would then have a better understanding as to how therefore that the department would mitigate the challenges. But the fundamental question, what impact this 214 million had on the current financial year allocation? Because it seems as if this would have a huge impact in terms of your current performance plan that you might have submitted in relation to the budget. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, firstly, let's welcome the reports and the presentations that have been made. I think the points, in fact, some of my questions are covered. But I wanted to first go back to slide 52, the area that was covered by acting DG with regard to the issues of non-compliance on the employment equity plans by the employers. I think there is an indication of what steps that are taken, but they more to do with what the law says. Maybe if you can just take us on board as to what has been the success stories with regard to your interventions here, your interventions, because you cited the areas where there's been failures to comply, similarly to Basic Condition of Employment Act. Yeah, you cited the areas. Yeah, but in your report, if you read it, it's more when it talks about intervention, it talks more about what the law says, yeah, not what you actually have achieved. Yeah. So if maybe you can just try to balance me out, unless I miss out on your presentation. The second point is with regard to the vacancy. One of the reasons that is forwarded, which is more a principal reason with regard to non-expenditure, falls on the question of vacancies. The critical question would be the number of vacancies other than the inspectors are in fact a critical post that talks to finance, supply chain, and so on. What steps have we taken? I think you have sufficiently covered with regard to the inspectors. So can you then cover the other side? Because it more speaks to provinces, where provinces have failed. If you look into the quarters, starting from quarter one, you have accounted for the reason for non-expended. That is the failure to fill those critical goals. So if you can maybe, again, just help us understand as to, so far as quarter four, what improvements and interventions that have been made. The next question, Chair, relates to the issue of the SEEs. Yeah. So with regard to the tenders, I think the question has been covered earlier on. But I want just again to rephrase the question, particularly with regard to engagements directly with the National Treasury. If National Treasury has to impose specific or fixed pricing for this entity, what returns or what obligations can we on our side impose or push for, or what concessions can we ask for from National Treasury, so that we are able therefore to deal with this problem of unfair competition, wherein when we tender, we in fact placed into a worse off position. So if maybe DDD can just help us to make suggestions, or if he thinks that it would be, what would be important or helpful for intervention would be maybe some formal representation or engagement with the National Treasury. Well, the last point relates to the last presentation of the Unemployment Insurance Fund. I think the last part of the presentation again was littered by a number of non-expended. Yeah. And if perhaps can they just help us to understand what plan of action do they want to be, are they putting in place so that they are able to deal with that? Because almost virtually all the last part it was non-expended. Yeah. So if they can just take us on board on their planned interventions. Yes.
No, thank you very much. So on non-compliance in terms of the sector, there's one that I'm very interested in, how do you interact with them, which is a very challenging space, the domestic workers. I know in the presentation last time, you did say that you had meetings with the employees, but I've never heard you saying you are also trying to call us, all of us employees and yourselves to call us to try in this way. Is it easier to call workers than to call the employers? If I can just get on some of the areas, then maybe one more conclusion, because I'm quite interested. I've been listening since we have been interacting with you people in terms of the inspectors, the UIF, the claims. I don't know whether it's not a mammoth task. You will explain how you can assist us. In terms of the inspectors, one would like to have a breakdown of your inspectors in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of age, and in terms of class. Same applies to claims on both the compensation fund, and I will then tell the department why I'm interested in that when you come for quarter one on that. So that question was triggered by one member that was saying those who are in private and those that are in public. But it's important when we talk about transformation and we talk about a particular sector or segment of the society, which is youth. In fact, not only gender, class, race, age, people with disabilities. I've applied that in the particular stage. Response?
UIFJ, with your indulgence. Previously the public representatives used to make a contribution to UIF. I'm not sure whether the policy changed during my previous years or in my time. I used to contribute to UIF while I was a public representative, but in the local government sphere. And now we are no longer contributing. Has the department looked at the policy impact on taking out a particular sector in relation to their revenue generation and the ceiling thereof of the contributors to the UIF fund? Can therefore that be a review taken into account, although the policy might have to be sustainable for a particular period? But I think taking into account the economic downtrends, therefore the policy doesn't have an impact now in terms of the funds that the department or the agency is currently administering. I'm not sure whether my question is clear. Yeah.
Okay. Responses? DG?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We'll start with the Competition Fund, followed by the UI. Mr. Mulatawa will follow. Ms. Madeleine is going to have his Adam.
Thank you, Chair. The a majority of our claims, I would say maybe about 99% of the claims that we have are with the private sector. Now, in the public sector, we do have some hospitals that would do IOD cases. The biggest problem with that is that they, with COINAU, there is a requirement for medical reports before we do any payment, before we do any pre-approval. And there is never time, I think, for the doctors in the public sector, because they see so many clients, not just only the IOD patients. So you end up with a situation where the claimant doesn't get the finalization of the claim because of outstanding reports and so on. So there's always preference from employers to send, when the worker is injured, to send the worker to a private health facility so that the worker can get treatment. But there are some. We can provide the breakdown next time we present. And there was a question on the global value. There is a slide that talks to the payments that we've made in the different programs. In the last financial year, we paid about 4 billion rand in medical claims. So now the numbers, in the slide, the numbers, the 937,000, those are the invoices, the medical individual medical invoices that you've received for the various treatments that a client would have had, be it in a hospital or with a treating practitioner. But the actual number of claims that were reported, it's also on the slide. What happened when I show the slide? It's about 190,000 claims that were registered. Now, claims would relate to from minor injuries to major injuries. It's just all injuries that have been reported to the fund. It can be a small cut in the finger that required a treatment from a doctor and so on. So what we've done, we recognize that the paying compensation in an event of an injury is a preventative measure. It's more of a reactive measure. We wanted to play a bigger role in preventing workplace injuries and diseases. So that's why we've partnered with the inspection and enforcement unit to try and increase capacity within the occupational health and safety unit so that they can start playing a role in helping employers to prevent workplace injuries. So our partnership is in the form of, now we've taken over the funding for occupational health and safety in the department, so that the department can have capacity to be able to expand the occupational health and safety inspectors that we have to be able to do the prevention work that we want to have. Can you go to the previous slide before that? The slide before this one. Go up. No, down, sorry, go down. Can you go down? Okay, so there is a slide that talks to the total number of incidents that were reported. The 90% cases adjudicated within 40 days. Let's go up. Yes. So the total number of claims that have been registered in the financial year that just ended is 156,223. So out of those claims, the 900,000 invoices would relate to these injuries, plus also injuries that would have happened in the prior years where, for example, a person requires further medical treatment, or something that would have occurred in the past where there is a continuous treatment that is required. I think I've responded to all the questions. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, I'll respond from the UIF. I think the first question was relating to the under expenditure, and if members can refer to slide 36. There are two areas where we have not spent the budget, where we have underspent, and the action plan around that on the CAPEX one, I did indicate to say the cause for the contributory factor on the under expenditure was failure for us to appoint the service provider on time. So in the current financial year, we rolled all these areas that we did not implement in the previous financial year, we rolled them over to the current financial year. So members will see when we report the performance of 1920, where we'll be appointing. Actually, has already been appointed, the service provider has already been appointed. We're now only at a process where the old service provider has to do a handover to the new service provider, and then they will develop the remaining reports and implement the system, so we'll spend the budget in the current financial year according to plan if everything goes well. The second contributor I did indicate to say we planned to roll the Wi-Fi to 126 labor centers. So at the end of the financial year, we only managed to roll to 33 labor centers. So the remaining labor centers are included in the current year plan. And I think members will see when we present quarter three report, because we targeted that we're going to finalize the remaining labor centers around October. So as we roll out to additional labor centers, then the budget will be spent. The other under expenditure relates to the post that we did not implement, that we didn't appoint people. Members will see when we come in, we report quarter two of 1920 financial year. We have already appointed those call center agents. They have started to work. So the budget is being spent in the current financial year that we did not spend. The other one was on the review of our ceiling. Also maybe the impact in changing policy in terms of when certain sectors are excluded that were contributing before. So the process that we normally follow is whenever there's a change, because in this one it was changing legislation, not necessarily in policy. So when we, because the process will go through NEDLAC, where people will suggest these are the different people that must be covered or excluded and all of that. So after that process is finalized, we take that to our actuaries. So they do the impact analysis. So they look at the changes that are in the Act, and they look at the impact it will have on us paying benefit, but they also look at the impact that it will have in terms of contribution that we lose, and then they will give us a report to say the changes that we are requesting, are they sustainable for the fund or not. So in the same process that it was followed, and they actually did look at it because the sector was very small. So in terms of the contribution that we're going to forfeit when they are no longer contributing, there was no much impact. And the reason behind that, I think you also highlighted on the issue of the ceiling review, because what normally happens is on a yearly basis, you will have Minister of Labour together with the Minister of Finance where they will review the contribution ceiling, maybe just for the background of the members. The contribution ceiling, or the ceiling that we're referring to, is for, in terms of legislation, employees must pay 1% of their salaries and the employer must pay 1%. Now what the ceiling means is on someone who earns, so the current ceiling that was agreed between Minister of Labour and Minister of Finance is about 17,824. So what it means in principle, so the two ministers will agree to say this will be the contribution ceiling for UIF. So what it means is if someone earns 30,000, when they contribute towards UIF, we don't calculate 1% of the 30,000, but we calculate the 1% based on the ceiling. So instead of someone contributing 1% of 30,000, which is the salary, he will contribute 1% of the 17,000 that is being agreed to towards UIF. But anyone who's earning less than 17,000, they pay their contribution according to their salaries. Now, what has happened, because I think the other indication was, what do we do in the current economic condition? So one of the, what happened in the last year, the Minister of Finance, he did request that we, because of the economic condition, because normally they have to increase that ceiling every year. So the Minister of Finance requested the Minister of Labour that they give employees and employer a break period. So there was no increment on the ceiling, taking into account the current economic condition. However, there's a ceiling that we take into account when you pay benefit. So the one of paying benefit, it was increased, but the one of contribution was kept at that level to take into account economic condition. What it means in principle is what we pay is more than what we collect. Because if someone earns 30,000, he will contribute based on 17,000, but when we process a claim, we use the 30,000 that this person is actually earning to determine the benefit that we pay over. However, in the previous financial year, our actuaries have indicated to us that we need to review that process, because I think members have seen, have indicated that we have overspent on benefit payment. So what is tend to now come is, after the implementation of the Amendment Act, we actually pay more benefit, we pay more rent value. So the actuaries normally will project over a period of time, so they've already indicated to us that we're going to have a problem if we don't increase the ceiling, because we now pay more benefit because of the new Amendment Act. So it's a process that we'll have to reconsider with the new minister, that we'll have to increase on the ceiling. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. There are two questions that I'm going to deal with. The first one relates to internship. Now, I'll try and answer it at, you know, three different levels. Generally, when skills development was under the Department of Labor until 2009, before the pronouncement and the transfer to the Department of Higher Education and Training, the CITAS and the National Skills Fund used to fund various programs that includes learnerships, internships, apprenticeships, skills programs, bursaries, and so on. Now, currently there are discussions in the light of the pronouncement by the President on the future of skills development and how we relate to them and so on. But secondly, as the department, I think colleagues within UIF did indicate that to try and make sure that people who are retrenched are able to find their way back into employment, there are various programs that they fund through partnerships with various parties that include CETAS. So those programs will include learnerships and a whole range of them, including internships. Now, thirdly, as the department, to support our programs and as part of succession planning and to create a base for recruitment within IEF, within PEF, within administration, we do take on a number of young people that we train through various internship programs and funding them from the 1% payroll that we normally keep as part of the skills development, in order to make sure that we are able to recruit some of them into positions that arise in the department. The second question, I think there was a suggestion by honourable member initially around SEE, around ring fencing and so on, and efforts that can be done. That is precisely what we are appealing for. However, there are a number of issues here. The entities used to get preferential treatment. If you look at government printers, GCIS, no government department can go and do their printing out there. We go to government printers, and they then, if they have a serious workload, they will then outsource to other areas, but we have to go through government department. These entities, in the earliest, government departments were forced to buy furniture from them, and the then government had a reason, and one of them was that they had a lot of retired or people who came from the military, who retired from police and so on. And if they were not going to support those factories, they would have encountered major problems, because they used to employ in excess of 3,500. If you go to police stations, correctional services, you can still see the kind of furniture that was produced from there. So that there was an element of preferential treatment, and only if they cannot supply or if there's more order, is then that government department went somewhere. Since Treasury took away that status, we've been engaging them. The challenge that we're seeking is that there are different divisions within Treasury. The one division, for instance, will normally approve price list, they fix the prices. The other division will say, no, you can't have preferential treatment, we must test the market, we must allow competition. And we've been trying to get the different parties, but amongst themselves they don't agree. And these are some of the things that we will continue to pursue. I think the last DG tried a number of things. There was a formal written request and formal request for further meetings, and these are some of the things we are pursuing. I must also indicate that Treasury did allow us to charge 50%. They have also allowed in one division I think that they are flexible to a certain extent around our procurement process, that government departments like health and so on don't have to follow long, tedious processes when they procure from us. But other government departments, for various reasons, the CFOs are not keen to work directly with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, ATDG. The question on the vacancy rate at the end of quarter four, because we report, I think what Mr. Murugawa was saying earlier was that we, at the moment, we've got figures that relate to the current moment, and yet we have to report on what happened in quarter four. But anyway, I think it also helps to give a trend. From the 31st of March, we're at 9.2% vacancy rate, and the norm within the public service is 9.9. So if you are below 9.9, you seem to be doing better. So that's the number they've decided, NCPFE and the president. Now, 9.2 for us translates to 156 posts. We've got a total establishment of 9,000 thereabouts. So at the end of July, between then and now, we are at 8%, and the total post is 792 vacant posts. Now, remember, in the department, I think it's one of the retention strategies that also we employ within the department. We tend to want to employ and promote from within. So sometimes you find that the net effect is zero. You don't see any movement in terms of the vacancies because you're picking from the bottom up. So there's a zero effect. And then there's a little bit of employment from outside, which will then give some bit of movement, that little lateral movement. But it's not, doesn't mean that the posts are vacant for a very long time. It means there's this internal movement within the post. Now, the provincial offices, I don't have the breakdown per province, but we can provide that later at a later stage. But what the DG has done was that every branch head and every provincial head, they have to provide their age analysis of their vacancies, because the turnaround time for us is to fill a vacant post is 6 months when you look at the entire recruitment and selection process. So 6 months is the norm that you need to be filling a vacant post. So any post that is more than a year old, the DG will then decide with top management whether to abolish that post. Because we also face a situation where we're going to experience a budget cut on compensation of employees, because funds are going to be reallocated to other needy areas within the public service. So with that budget cut, it means we then need to identify the posts that are 1 year and more older that will then be abolished, depending on whether they are critical posts or not. Because the belief is that if a post has been vacant for a year, what were you doing? I mean, you can manage without that post, obviously, if you can leave it vacant for more than a year. So we are busy with that process at the moment within the department. I don't think there was any other big aspect. I think I've answered the question. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, regarding the question that was raised by Honourable Notes, it's a very loaded question. Can answer it in the form of a presentation or just summarise. There's a lot of value add that we do as the inspectorate, and there are a lot of success stories. But just to, in the interest of time, just to pick on a few, there are companies that we've worked a journey with, from instances where they had no idea what the offerings of an Employment Equity Act are, to a point where they are now substantively complying with DG recommendations, which is a big step because it says they are making real changes. Several companies that you've added, we've assisted. We've recovered millions and millions of rands. Some of the money that we recover go to the fiscals. We've had companies that won't be complying with employment equity after we've issued out all the notices. Some of them have agreed to settle out of court. They pay amounts ranging from 200,000 up to 700,000. Then it goes back to the fiscals. There are instances where you get to recover money for people, which is, those issues are bread and butter issues, because people, where there's been illegal deductions and people get their money back, we've got cases like that. With OHS, there are instances where productivity levels will just go up, because wellness will become the norm. Emotional wellness and decreased levels of absenteeism, when you take care of your, a happy employer, employee is an employee that is also productive. So we've got case studies along those lines. Chair, your question, Madam, you're 100% correct. We target domestic workers rather than employers to a large degree. Our resources, which are not limitless, are skewed towards those that are most vulnerable. If you look at the relationship between employer and employee, it's a power-based relationship, with employers being in a more powerful position. So they are more likely to abuse their powers, and employees to be on the receiving end. And if you look at the domestic sector, that's where we get most of our vulnerable people. Unionization rates are extremely low, so those people don't have a voice. So we actually go an extra mile in terms of helping them with hands-on projects. But where employers are concerned, we do high level advocacy through all the media platforms where we are able to then get their attention. But yes, our resources are skewed towards domestic workers. And then in terms of the profile of the DOL inspectors, in terms of gender, age, and all those things, we'll make that information available.
Just a quick one, Chair. The appreciation of the responses, in particular the last one and the second last. The point why we're raising this question is that, firstly, that scoring 100% it's a big yes to the department, because with regard to, I understand what the DDG was explaining, but the point is that your report sits below 100%. Yeah, so if you can find a way. The second point is the tidbits that acting DG is raising. It's a scorecard politically. We need those tidbits one way or the other. If they can find a way of supplementing the report, even if it's not going to the core report, so that we're able then to have this practical example, so that when we talk about the efficacy and the effectiveness of the Employment Equity Act, we're able then to give concrete examples. Yeah.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. We will, I think we want to thank you for the presentations, but also thanking you for being patient with us. You will see when we are in the top gear, we're almost there, and don't be surprised. But I think I've observed the level of patience in taking us through. We are still going to come back, and then when is that time of the annual report, then things change. And because fortunately you will be coming with the quarter one of the current financial year, our mind still fresh from the last quarter of the. So the stampede has assisted us in one way or another. And when I know it's a mammoth task, but try even my favorite. Yes, SEE, we will also need that information in terms of demographics, gender, age. It would be at that time when we tell you why we think it is. Because when we talk about transformation,
Those are the things that we must not be apologetic about that. And in fact, in that also, the empowerment rate skills that which are outside what they are able to do, and where you think that they can be assisted in moving forward. Yes, it's one of the institutions, as we were just talking informally with the members, it's one of the institutions that we think that we will visit. Because the debate in terms of the unemployment crisis in the country is coming to the fore in Parliament. So the information, will come back to you on the information that we need on the first week of September. There's a motion that has been tabled, and we're going to be engaged in that debate. So it's the information that we say we're going to need. We will appreciate if you take it serious. As I've always been saying, that this process is not just about you coming to make a presentation. We are being empowered. You are being empowered. So it's a two-way process. Working together, we can then begin to, difficult as it's going to be, the mindset and the narrative in the country about unemployment and employment. What is this thing that... So we have got that responsibility as Parliament through this committee of ensuring that we are then able to make people understand what exactly is this that we are talking about. The unfortunate part is that we will then be talking about it when the emotions are very high in the country and in the world. But a person that is unemployed here in South Africa is not interested. Obviously, I'm going to tell that this is a global phenomenon. They're not interested in that. He or she wants to put a plate on the table. She wants to, or he wants to be in a decent home. So employment goes with decent employment, workers being governed, the act, are our workers aware, what is it that is making them aware, not aware. So it takes us back to what people don't want us to refer to our history. You are to refer to your history for you to be able to move forward. Not that we are always going to be stuck on our history. No, our history is forever. Because if we want to make change, there are things that we can't just forget about them. So we are in that space, which is a space that is very challenging. So thank you very much. We will then be coming, you'll be coming again very soon. You'll get the date, but it has been nice working with you, and thank you very much. Tomorrow you are here, so you are still here tomorrow. Otherwise, where is the venue for tomorrow so that they leave? S26. For those of you that has been part of the furniture in this institution, you tell your colleague Tando where is S26. Same time. No. What's the time? 9:30 tomorrow. Please. Okay. As the department is leaving, I will then request members to be. You have harassed me when I'm successful. Thank you.
Can we? I hope members do have a copy of the minutes of the 5th of July. No, they did say that they sent their comments. Any in the light of are we any comments? I think they are a true reflection. Can we then get a mover and a seconder? Honourable Gabbard.
Thanks, Josephine, and members of the committee. The minutes are the true reflection of what was discussed on the meeting of the 5th of July 2019. So I move for the adoption of the minutes. Thank you.
Can I just say this, that for Hansai, I know
Honorable Chairperson, I Nobuhle Gabane, I propose for the move of for the adoption of the minutes.
Can we get a second? Honorable Nonsai.
I Honorable Max Nonsai second the motion for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. Tomorrow we are, I just want to humbly request members so that in yesterday, in tomorrow's presentation, we are able to make that comparison because both quarter three and quarter four were back to back. So if you can, when you come tomorrow, come with your document, the last week document, so that you are just able, not unless you have already, just to remind, so that you are able to make that comparison that well in this quarter and in even all the issues that they have faced, if then that is possible. In the same document here, you will see that we do NEDLAC presentation is in this presentation. The only presentation that is going to be circulated is CCMA and Productivity SA. I want to say it upfront that members will the standard practice is that at least you must get the presentation within a certain time, but because it has been quite a pet program, we will pardon the department for now, but as we move forward, I'll be speaking with the secretariat in terms of
trying that the first quarter of the financial year be circulated on time, so that at least when we come to the meeting, having been able to go through and we are prepared. Thank you very much, honorable members. Until we meet again tomorrow, F26 is the NCOP. So when you go in, instead of turning left, you turn right as if you are going to traveling, but you don't go there, you go straight, there's a passage there, you go straight to that side, either you go up the stairs or you go to the small lift. I will tell you the story about that lift, why I'm afraid of it. But F26 is in the NCOP side. Thank you very much.